I'm Rebecca Vallis. The hidden poisoning of poor children at an LA housing complex. Sexual assault continues to pervade the news, to put it lightly, and more. Lots going on this week. But first, Jeremy Slevin returns to give us a roundup of the news in poverty this week. Jeremy!
Great to be here.
How's it hanging?
It's going pretty well.
So, did you have plans last night?
Well, disclosure, we're taping on Thursday, so did you have any plans on Wednesday this week?
Well, I did something that hopefully we won't have to do for a long, long time.
I watched
the final debate. And
this is our final debate.
And now we have a final tally of what the moderators asked about at these debates. And so here's the final score. 0 questions on poverty or any policies that would help people in poverty.
I have to argue with that. No, I'm not even going to wait for your tally.
Okay.
I still think the first debate did better than a lot of folks are giving it credit for, because the first question out of the gate was about income inequality. It mentioned improvements in income. It also mentioned jobs as being critical to people who are struggling in this economy. And it mentioned that there were two economies.
True. And it mentioned inequality. It mentioned people living paycheck to paycheck. I'm not counting it because it was still technically a jobs question.
But poverty is about jobs.
Oh, okay, so we'll give 1 to poverty.
Thank you. One
question about climate. Okay.
All right.
0 on climate. Any quibbles?
No.
0 on LGBT issues. 0 on
LGBT.
Yeah. 0 campaign finance.
Really?
Yeah. And the list goes on. Obviously.
How many on emails?
I don't have that.
How many on ISIS?
5 on ISIS, 7 on Russia, 3 on national debt.
How many on Social Security?
2, though I don't have the numbers in front of me.
But how many good questions on Social Security?
I would say 0.
Maybe 9. I will confess to having been extraordinarily peeved at Chris Wallace when he asked the question about Social Security, in particular because he framed it as how and would you cut Social Security, as opposed to, like, how do you keep the program strong? It was amazing how stuck in 1993, right. That question was.
Yeah, and there were a couple times he did that. What was the other? Oh, on the stimulus. He was like, it's agreed that the stimulus slowed growth.
Right.
Which he started editorializing and B is wrong.
Well, we expect editorializing from Fox News. But also, yeah, he was starting from premises that were not even widely accepted.
Right. So, what do you think? Was the stimulus a good idea? What would you do differently?
So, paging Chris Wallace, if you'd like to know, cutting Social Security is widely unpopular with, Americans across political parties, across income levels, across age groups. So, if you'd like to catch up to your viewers at any point, feel free.
Well, thankfully, he's an avid listener, so.
Yeah.
If you're listening, Chris Wallace.
We'd love to have you on to talk more about this. So what else is going on, Jeremy?
In other debate-related news, we talked a little bit last week about the federal court cases on people being robbed of their right to vote. And now we have a tally. So there are 14 states this year that have new voting restrictions in place for the first presidential cycle. And this is also the first election where the Voting Rights Act won't be in full effect, the first presidential election. So if people want to talk about this election being fixed, it's not, but there are people whose vote is being restricted, and this, of course, as you know, falls mainly on low-income people, communities of color, seniors, college students, especially voter ID laws, because those communities...
People with disabilities.
Yep.
All right, so anything brighter? Do we have any good news this week?
I'm scrolling through to look for the good news. It's not coming up in my magic news machine.
Okay, so what else do we have that's not
good? Well, this is a good ending. There is a strike on 14 state universities in Pennsylvania. This is 5,000 professors and coaches are on strike for health insurance benefits. These people affect more than 100,000 students, and many of the students are joining them. This comes after the Harvard strike for many of their workers, and it's it's spreading, which the Harvard strike was the first strike in 30 years on a campus.
Well, I think that this necessitates a full segment to explore the role of unions on college and university campuses, adjuncts in particular being subject to exploitative practices and lack of fair wages and such. So committing here, hold me honest, keep me honest, Jeremy, but committing here to doing a segment on labor conditions and pay on universities and college campuses.
Absolutely. And I'll just say on a related note, there was a study of full-time administrative staff at the University of California, and they found that 45% of the university system's full-time administrative staff go hungry at times during the year.
Did you say 45%?
45%. These are staffers at the University of California school system, you know, one of the most elite institutions of higher education.
I'm stunned into silence, and that doesn't happen often. As you
I mean, these kind of I think there are more kind of small studies about food insecurity that's showing just how widespread it is, but it's really shocking.
And then it's people all around us, right? It's amazing. All right, well, we'll have to take a look at that as well. So there are also some, you know what, maybe some good news here, right? We have some action out of New York when it comes to bad behavior by police officers. And the city actually doing something about it. What's going on there?
Yeah, so there was a shooting of a fatal shooting of a mentally ill woman in New York. Mayor Bill de Blasio came out and called it unacceptable. And she was shot on Tuesday by a police sergeant. She was in her Bronx apartment. But I haven't seen any action, unless I'm missing something, but that, you know, is it a high-profile shooting? And at least there's condemnation from the mayor.
Well, I think condemnation is something. I think, yeah, I mean, unless I've read this incorrectly, my understanding is that the police department actually is going to reprimand the officer, and so that is taking action in response to inappropriate behavior, particularly with respect to non-civilians with disabilities.
Right. And, of course, this isn't the first time there's been a high-profile death at the hands of New York City police.
But particularly when it comes to people with disabilities coming into contact with the police, something we definitely looked at. So I'm going to put that in the good news column. We'll see what comes from it. That obviously will be correct, but I'm glad that they're at least looking into it and taking it seriously.
Something else in the good news column is just a study of public housing compared siblings, one of whom was in a public housing system and another who wasn't, or they were in it for different amounts of time. These researchers found that 10 years of public housing actually raises a kid's future income by about 50%, which is an enormous benefit. And there haven't been a lot of studies that in this apples-to-apples way that compared, you know, people in similar families, and they also found that it reduces the chance of incarceration.
So really, really important, I think, you know, particularly as we continue to track the role of social insurance and public assistance and various government anti-poverty programs, and what difference they make and how they help kids, not just in the short term, but also in the long term. And do we have any updates on the fallout from Wells Fargo?
We do. There's actually new information about just who was targeted with these accounts. And some of the people targeted by these aggressive salespeople essentially were Mexican immigrants who spoke little or no English, older adults with memory problems, college students who were trying to open their first bank account, small business owners with several lines of credit.
And these were the people that the bankers were actually like specifically targeting for either unnecessary or unauthorized
interactions, essentially taking advantage of these people. And one of the employees that the analogy that I use was like little lions hunting zebras.
Lions hunting zebras. Oh, I also love the rest of this quote. They look for the weakest, the ones that were caught up the least resistance. It almost looked, I mean, we've seen this come out of, you know, lots of different investigations into terrible business practices, but it reminds me of for-profit colleges and who they go after when
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Welcome back to Top Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Last week marked the 25th anniversary of Anita Hill's famous testimony in Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings, and this week marks the anniversary of Thomas's swearing in as a Supreme Court justice. Hill's testimony recounting sexual harassment by Clarence Thomas was widely dismissed as not credible and even a symptom of supposed mental instability. But today, sexual harassment and sexual assault are back in the news and dominating the presidential campaign. How much has changed in the years since? With me to discuss is Lisa Lynn Jacobs. She's the legal and policy director at the Center for Survivor Agency and Justice. Lisa Lynn, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So just starting back at the Anita Hill hearings, you were 1 year out of law school when all of that was playing out. Share a little bit about what it was like to watch that unfold.
It was, I think I'm literally without words. I had at that moment just wrapped up a fellowship at the National Partnership for Women and Families. So I had done a year of advocacy around a variety of issues relating to access to justice for women of color, for women and their families. And then to see the way in which Anita Hill, who was profoundly credible, came forward with advisors like Professor Susan Deller Ross at Georgetown and others, and, you know, offered a story which is, as you point out, back in the news, which is incredibly familiar, and was basically dismissed by the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, was on some levels branded an activist. I remember Senator Heflin of Alabama asking, you know, if she wanted to write a book, if she, in his, you know, great Southern brogue, was she a civil rightser, right? They were, now Justice Thomas had been brought forward by somebody that he worked for, Senator Danforth, and the Senate being an institution of privilege, they were extending every ounce of privilege to then Judge Thomas. He'd been on the D.C. Circuit, and were looking for a way to expedite getting him on the bench because the year begins for the Supreme Court in October. So we were already in mid-October. There were then, as now, ironically, 8 justices, and they wanted to seat now Justice Thomas expeditiously. So while they heard Anita Hill's testimony, they rushed to discredit it, and he was confirmed and sworn into the court just 1 week later, as you pointed out.
And her testimony, it went on for days.
That's right.
Some people have actually become sort of re-familiarized with that recounting of events because of a recent HBO documentary. Well, not a documentary. It's a sort of a mockumentary as
right.
It plays out. But it literally went on for days.
Right.
What was it like to watch that painstaking treatment of a woman because she was not seen as credible simply because of her status as a woman, and not just a woman, but a married woman?
Right. I think it was awkward. I think it was uncomfortable. There were no women on the Senate Judiciary Committee at that point. There were no people of color on that committee. One of the things that I've pointed out is that the activism that that arose in the women's community in response to that hearing spurred a number of things. It spurred a huge spike in the number of Title VII filings around employment discrimination against women. But what it also spurred was a number of women to run for high office. A year later, I guess 3 years later, was known as the Year of the Women. The Year of the Woman, excuse me. Senator Patty Murray ran and was elected that year. Senator Carol Moseley Braun ran and was elected that year. And I say that to say that, you know, part of the ripples there were the beginnings of diversity, gender diversity in the Senate. But when Hill testified, she sat before a panel of all white men. And Justice Thomas, you know, used every maneuver that he could, including invoking all sorts of specters of race discrimination and calling, you know, the whole hearing process a high-tech lynching. So, you know, there were basically people tiptoeing around because they were uncomfortable from a race standpoint, but they also literally did not have the terminology to talk about what now Professor Hill was talking about. They literally did not have a way in which to address it or to respond to it or to think about what an appropriate response was.
Now, we don't have a good figure of how many women or what percentage of women experience sexual assault over the course of their lives because it's sort of a dark figure, precisely because many women choose not to come forward.
Sure.
And a lot of what goes on in deciding whether to come forward is the fear of not being believed and of actually receiving the kind of treatment that Professor Hill received in those hearings.
That's correct. Well, I think we could say a couple of things, right? This administration has mounted an unprecedented response to issues around sexual and domestic violence. We are now in our second, but this particular administration appointed the first White House advisor on violence against women. But particularly with respect to statistics, what we do know is that 1 in 5 women are likely to experience sexual assault while they are in higher ed, while they're in their college years. Sexual assault is also an issue for males. It's an issue in intimate partner relationships. So, and this administration has been fabulous in terms of advocacy on that issue, in terms of saying to people, we believe you. You know, the vice president has literally tweeted, you know, messages of support to individuals experiencing these issues.
Including being a visible part of the It's On Us campaign.
Yes, absolutely. Also something started by the White House, but really started by the White House and, you know, with the goal of spurring student activism in higher education, which is precisely what it has done. There are, you know, It's On Us groups on many college and university campuses because there really has been an unprecedented focus on this issue by the administration, but an unprecedented reaction in college campuses owning this issue, student advocacy organizations, men's groups owning this issue, stepping up to it, and really doing what It's On Us, the goal of It's On Us is, which is to intervene. That is about bystander intervention and people stepping in, which is something I have to say that, you know, we wish we had seen more of in the context of the campaign and these discussions. The notion that people should be stepping up and saying this behavior is inappropriate. This is unacceptable. And the demanding of accountability that we are seeing on campus, you know, really is heartening to folks like me who have been doing this work for 25 or so years to really have seen the arc of that and see the response now. But I will say that one thing that is very consistent with what we saw in 1991 with Professor Thomas's testimony, excuse me, Professor Hill's testimony spurring the response in terms of filings under Title VII, is that what we have seen in this political environment is a huge spike in calls to RIC crisis centers and hotlines. I know that, you know, they've been seeing somewhere between, depending on which crisis center you talk to, a 20 to 35% increase in the number of calls that they are receiving.
It's staggering.
It's staggering, but it is also trauma. We are talking about, you know, many people being re-traumatized as a result of what we are hearing and seeing every day. You know, I said to somebody yesterday who was expressing to me, and somebody who's a very, you know, a very visible sort of high-profile feminist, we were at an event, and she turned to me and she said, you know, I'm really feeling stressed. I'm really feeling anxious. And I said, that is trauma. That is a response to trauma. When you turn on the radio and you hear either that another woman has come forward with a complaint about a political candidate, or relatedly, if you turn on the radio and you hear that there's been another situation involving law enforcement and the homicide of a black man, and you don't know which one you are talking about, I've just described what, you know, what happened this summer into this fall. It has been wall-to-wall trauma, I think, for many people. And certainly I commend crisis lines, and I know that entities like the American Psychological Association and others are literally making support groups available because they understand that people are, you know, surfacing and grappling with things that they may have pushed from their minds a long time ago. I know Diane Rehm, for instance, the very popular Washington, D.C. radio personality, has talked a little bit about how being constantly exposed to this news has been re-traumatizing for her and how it's caused her to, again, focus on some things that happened to her, some child sexual abuse that occurred for her.
Which is, it's just incredibly, obviously, important for people to come forward in that way.
Yes.
And to say, I don't feel stigmatized.
Yes.
I am comfortable speaking about this. It's a, this is a personal issue for me as someone who experienced sexual assault when I was a younger person.
Right.
And it's something I live with and think about every time it's in the news. So
right.
I appreciate your, I think, very apt characterization of not really post-traumatic stress disorder,
right.
but sort of ongoing
yes.
trauma that we are all, many of us, yes. experiencing in this campaign cycle. But I'm curious to hear you opine on how much has changed or has not changed since the Anita Hill hearings, given that so many of the women who are coming forward are now being believed.
Right. So, again, Anita Hill really opened that door. And I think that, again, we saw a spike in responses in terms of Title VII and filings, et cetera, on the sexual harassment side. We now have, as I said, an administration that has been really responsive, that has said to survivors of violence, we believe you, that has, in the campus violence context, done unprecedented work in terms of literally creating fora where federal officials sat and listened to, welcomed survivors of violence to come and share their experiences and talk about what either went right or went wrong in the campus violence context when people brought forward a complaint, and literally has provided a forum enabling people to be heard. I really credit the work of this administration because I think that it helped the people who experienced the harassment and the violence at the hands of the candidate to know that they would be believed. They were doing that in an unprecedented environment where for 8 years an administration has been funding these issues, has been paying attention to these issues, has been holding events at the White House on these issues and saying, we believe you, we want to respond to this, we want to see these issues addressed, and it's not your fault.
Has there also been a change in the media and its approach to covering these issues? I'm also thinking in particular about the number of women who came forward around Bill Cosby,
mm-hmm.
Sharing their stories and being believed by the mm-hmm. media. Has the media changed in its approach?
Well, I think the media has changed in a number of ways, not least of which in this particular, this most recent set of stories, because one of the women who was victimized is herself a journalist, right? The personal is political. But I think that it's also that when you see, to the extent that anyone might be inclined at this point to be dismissive of one person or one person's story, when you see, I think, 30 people come forward in the instance of Bill Cosby, when you see more than 10 women come forward and say, and, you know, what they're coming forward is really a response, right? I mean, what we first had, appallingly enough, was a candidate who was taped making these comments about his predatory behavior, about having committed sexual assault. And so that engendered a response, right, which is, yes, that happened to me, right? And so that in and of itself was unprecedented. That's a way in which it doesn't mirror what happened with respect to the Thomas confirmation hearings. But, you know, this it has been unprecedented. And if there is a silver lining to this cloud, right, it is the number of people who have shared their own stories, you know, in Facebook, on Twitter, in response to other people. And I think that as we continue to recognize that this is literally almost every person's experience, right? That it will engender more resources, which I think are desperately needed for rape crisis centers and for other responses, but will help people to shake whatever stigma is remaining. Because I think that as a historical matter, there has been a lot of inclination of people to blame themselves on these issues. And so I just leave us all with the thought that no one is responsible for predatory behavior except the predator, and that people who have, as many of us have, been traumatized by these issues should not feel ashamed, should not feel stigmatized, and should come forward.
I've been speaking with Lisa Lynn Jacobs. She's the Legal and Policy Director at the Center for Survivor Agency and Justice, and folks who have experienced sexual assault or sexual harassment and are seeking resources for where to get help can go to talkpoverty.org for a listing of where they can go for help and support. Lisa Lynn, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on, Rebecca.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEAC Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Flint, Michigan drew national attention when it came to light that its residents were being quietly poisoned by lead in their water. Now, poor children in a Los Angeles public housing complex are suffering a similar fate due to lethal contaminants in the soil. Joining me to discuss is Bryce Covert. She covers economic policy and poverty for Think Progress. Bryce, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bryce, you took a look at a particular housing complex in Los Angeles. It's called the Jordan Downs Public Housing Complex, and some really, really scary stuff that hasn't been getting almost any attention in the national media. What's going on in Jordan Downs?
The parcel of land that the HACLA, which is the LA Housing Authority, bought was a factory site, and then this truck repair place had lots of soil containers and other things, soil stains, already when they bought it, and it seems to have a lot of contamination. So things like lead, arsenic, cadmium have been found there. residents. It's that there seems to be the potential that that has also contaminated their own lawns and yards where they're already living and their children have been playing outside. There has been some limited testing by HACLA that has shown what residents and advocates say is troubling signs. HACLA contends that it's nothing actionable, so they don't have to do anything to clean it up. And at this point, they have gone ahead with this project. So they've demolished four buildings, and they're doing construction on the new site, all of which is potentially kicking all of these chemicals up into the air, into their children's lungs or systems. And they're really concerned that not enough is being done to protect their health.
And Bryce, you mentioned that it was almost by accident that knowledge of the fact that this housing site is contaminated came to light. Tell us a little bit about the role of advocates, how this actually happened, and how the public records became visible. So they decided not to clean up the housing complex, but they went further than that. They actually sent public messages to the community living there that everything was fine. Though some of these public records also show that the same officials who decided that nothing needed to be done were also sending horribly racist and offensive emails amongst themselves referring to the residents of this community in just really, really horrible terms.
Right. So I believe that that's a separate public records request, but right, at the end of 2015, these emails come out who were making this decision. And advocates note that the population at Jordan's Downs is basically all people of color. They estimate it's about 70% Latino and 30% Black. So they very much feel that this is an example of environmental racism, that the concerns of these residents, these low-income people of color, are being brushed aside because of who they are and the kind of population they come from.
So at this point, the story becomes even more similar to the Flint water crisis because a coalition has formed, including not just housing advocates, but also Physicians for Social Responsibility, a group that advocates for public health, and they decided to take on the responsibility of testing themselves.
Yes. So there was our first round of limited testing, which advocates say already raised flags. What you can do is there's this gun that basically looks like one of those guns that traffic cops use, where you just sort of point it at the ground and take a reading, and it'll tell you what's in the soil. They went around, they did their own testing. They did 104 spots all over Jordan Downs. They found over half of their samples were above the threshold for lead. A third of them were above 100 parts per million. One reading was as high as 346 parts per million. They also found levels of arsenic that exceeded the threshold. They found cadmium, mercury, antimony. So basically what they said is they're not claiming that these test results are necessarily, you know, the gold standard. But what they're trying to say to HACWA is this shows that we need to do more. You need to do more testing. You need to find out exactly what is going on there. And then you need to take action to clean it up. That testing, although HACWA says that testing is misleading, that testing seems to have provoked them because earlier this year, HACWA did another round of its own testing at four buildings that it was planning to demolish. What's disturbing is that it said outright, we're not going to wait to demolish these buildings for the test results to come back. Those buildings have already been demolished. But what we know is that the results there look a lot like what they found in 2014, which is that although they averaged it out to about the threshold in California, there were many readings where it was much higher than 80 parts per million.
Now, your reporting features multiple stories of people living there who really believe that their houses and that their living conditions have made them sick. You spoke with one resident who describes not being able to breathe well, always feeling like she needs to cough, but not being able to cough. People are even dying as well.
Yeah, I talked to Emma Cortez. She's been living there for so long that she remembers when the factory site was actually a factory. Before she even moved in there, she's been living at Jordan Downs for decades. And she told me that she's had this feeling, she said it was like dust in her throat that she can't clear, and her doctor told her that it's an allergy most likely caused by some sort of chemical contamination. She also says her two daughters, who she brought with her when she moved to Jordan Downs or when they were young, deal with frequent nosebleeds. Two of her friends have died of cancer. She knows many people who have children with autism. And Physicians for Social Responsibility also say they've heard lots of similar stories: asthma, low birth weight, ADHD, mental health disorders, all this stuff cropping up. I should say that there is not yet any comprehensive health data that we have. I believe Physicians for Social Responsibility is working on getting that. So this is all anecdotal at this point, but there was a nurse working with Physicians for Social Responsibility who said she noticed that the closer you get to Jordan Downs, the higher children's blood lead levels appear to be. So residents are very clear that they believe there is something happening to their health and it's being caused by where they live.
Now, back to those internal memos that were discovered when public records requests were made, one of those internal memos indicates that it would have cost about $10,000 to fully test the land, which was just a tiny, tiny fraction of the $31 million that the Housing Authority spent to buy the factory site. And they decided not to spend that $10,000, but now residents are also alleging that it's budget savings and a lack of desire to spend even incredibly small amounts of money, relatively speaking, that are keeping Hakla from wanting to do the necessary cleanup.
Yeah, the memo that I saw, which is internal, found that it would cost about $10,000 to fully test the land where people were already living. Might have cost a little bit more to also fully test the factory site. And again, you know, you have to put this into context of what Hakla is spending. It spent $31 million on the new parcel of land. It's spending about $1 billion on the entire project. And the advocates point out what we're asking for, you know, comprehensive testing, cleanup, is still likely to be a fraction of that overall cost. Wouldn't you rather get out in front of this, do the testing now, take the steps you need to take to make sure everybody is safe, and make sure that this new housing that people are looking forward to is also safe and in the interest of their health, rather than deal with it on the other end? I mean, you look at what happened in Flint. It's still an ongoing crisis, and it's still unclear exactly who's going to take what blame and how that's all going to play out. But it's very likely, there have been a number of lawsuits filed in Flint, that local and state governments are going to have to pay for what they did. If they had just gotten out in front of it and prevented the health crisis from the beginning, it would cost a lot less. And that's how these things often work out. If you prevent the health crisis in the first place, it does not actually cost all that much. If you let it happen and then you have to pay the price on the other end, not only have you done irreparable damage to people, but you also probably have to pay a whole lot more.
Now, this is not the first time that there has been an instance of potential widespread contamination at a public housing site. It came to light late last year that there was similar contamination in a Chicago Housing Authority complex. Children were coming back with massive levels of lead poisoning. And many advocates have now started to call for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, to take action, pointing to outdated regulations that don't require housing authorities at the local level to take any kind of action until children's lead levels are far above what the CDC requires. Give us a little bit of the broader context and also help us understand what are the solutions to make sure that this stops happening.
Yeah, so the story you're talking about is in East Chicago. We reported on it. My colleague Alex Lewinsky reported on this earlier. There's another public housing project dealing with something similar, although it appears that it's been decades of misinformation, and they're only now starting to find out that their soil has been laced with lead. What's important to realize with these public housing projects is that a lot of them across the country were built on former factory sites and contaminated land. It's land you can get for cheap, and then you can build these public housing projects on top of it. But as we're seeing over and over again, the necessary precautions to clean it up before people live there often weren't taken. Part of that may be that when they were built, we didn't know as much about things like lead. You know, our standards for what is safe when it comes to lead have gotten better and better, and the science has gotten better and better. But still, it has this legacy of poisoning people. And I personally just really think that the reason we don't hear about it more often, that these stories crop up and they don't cause a national outcry, is because of the populations who live there. They tend to be people of color, and they are almost always low-income people, and they just have less of a voice. There has been action. What's complicated a little bit when you're dealing with these things is that there's different agencies that have different jurisdictions. So in Jordan Downs, if you're talking about poisoned soil, you may be talking more about the EPA and again, you know, the BTSC, which is the California agency that regulates these chemicals. If you're talking about the house itself, then you're talking more about HUD, and I've reported on this as well. The biggest source of lead poisoning throughout the country, public housing and private housing alike, is actually inside of homes. It's lead paint that is still on a lot of old housing, on the walls of old housing. And HUD has been under a lot of pressure lately because it has a different level in public housing for when action is needed than what the CDC has said is the right action level. So in HUD housing, it's 20 micrograms per deciliter, and it's much much lower. I mean, basically, the CDC has said there is no safe level, but I believe it's 5 micrograms generally is the action level. So HUD has said it's working on that. I think that HUD is not brushing this aside, and it wants to update its regulations, but these things, unfortunately, move far slower than we'd like to, given the impact on people's health. And then there's the EPA. And the EPA, you know, has really been embroiled in what happened in Flint. Just yesterday, there was an EPA Inspector General report that came out that basically said the agency failed in its duties to the people of Flint by not intervening earlier when the city and state were basically messing the whole thing up. So I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on the EPA to get out in front of these crises, intervene when city and state governments are failing to do so. It's tough for the EPA. They are a politically charged agency. They are cautious because everything they do comes with huge conservative backlash. But we still need them to be acting. I mean, once a child is poisoned by lead, it is basically impossible to reverse that damage, and they live with it for the rest of their lives.
I've been speaking with Bryce Covert. She's the economic policy editor at Think Progress and frequently covers poverty-related issues such as this. Bryce, thank you so much for your reporting in this case, and we look forward to following the story, and hopefully action is on the horizon.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Most attention in this election has been paid to the choice that voters will make at the top of the ticket in November. But there's a lot more on the ballot that's important to workers and their families. Here to discuss what else is going on ballots around the country is Ryan Erickson. He does a lot of things at the Center for American Progress in our war room, but I'm going to dub him our state correspondent. Ryan, are you comfortable with that?
I will take it.
Can you be our correspondent on things in states?
In states.
Things in states.
I will state the state of the states.
The state of the states will be stated. I'm going to leave that there because I think we killed that one.
Yes.
It was dead. So, Ryan, there are ballot measures in a number of states that could change state policy when it comes to minimum wages and more. Give us a rundown.
Sure. Yeah. So I think the basic gist is that measures to increase the minimum wage are on the ballot in four states. So voters will get to decide. They'll get to weigh in directly on a chance to raise their state's minimum wages in Arizona, Colorado, Maine, and Washington, Washington State. In all four of those states, they have pretty robust minimum wage increases that have a good chance of making a pretty significant difference in the lives of low wage workers, to actually give them some of the income growth that we haven't seen take hold as evenly in this economic recovery as we until recently with the recent, I think, census results. We've been a little bit more worried about what's been happening to people at the lower end, and this is a good chance to make sure those folks are getting a raise too.
So there's been a lot of attention paid to the fact that Congress has failed to act to raise the minimum wage in 9 years, and as a result, workers have to work many, many more hours just to have the same take-home pay in real terms. Some analysis done by one of my colleagues actually found that a worker today has to work an extra 244 hours in a given year just to have the same earnings in real terms as they did the last time the minimum wage was raised. But tell me a little bit about how ambitious these ballot measures are. We've heard a lot about the fight for 15. Mm-hmm. Are they all going to 15? Are there different amounts?
Generally different amounts. So in Arizona, Colorado, and Maine, they are all proposals to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour by 2020, which actually mirrors the most recent federal bill that was put forward in this past Congress. Surprise, it didn't go anywhere. But that's exactly why states are increasingly taking these minimum wages and putting them up for a vote, because they also recognize how popular they are with voters and workers and voters across across the income spectrum, not just people who are earning at or near the minimum wage. And the ballot initiative in Washington is a little bit higher than that, in part owing to the fact that Washington's a little bit of a higher cost of living state, where they go to $13.50 by 2020. The other really good thing about a lot of these ballot initiatives is that they would index so that, you know, hopefully they get to keep, you know, inflation won't erode them in the future, and they'll actually get to keep, you know, pretty competitive with, you know, they'll set a pretty good standard working wage floor for people going forward and in the future.
Which ensures that the wage would actually keep pace with inflation.
Yes.
So that
mm-hmm.
policymakers wouldn't have to act over and over and
exactly.
over again, the problem
exactly.
we've seen at the federal level. And what would these ballot measures do, if anything, when it comes to tipped workers who often have a different wage floor than the regular minimum wage?
So in Colorado and Maine, the ballot initiatives will actually eliminate the tip minimum wage and just set one standard minimum wage across the board, so 12 by 2020 for everyone.
So what is it that is driving policymakers to now use ballot measures as opposed to legislation that needs to move through legislatures or other means for changing this policy?
One of my favorite questions.
Always happy to ask you your favorite questions.
Much like the minimum wage, I mean, it all comes back to money in a way. And that is that a lot of the groups that oppose minimum wage increases have, you know, significantly outsized power in state legislatures as they do in Congress when it comes to, you know, core economic issues that they do not support, like raising the minimum wage or establishing paid sick leave for families or paid family leave. And they tend to have a lot of support in the halls of Congress and in state legislatures, groups like the Chamber of Commerce and the National Federation of Independent Businesses and other similar trade associations like that. But, you know, these are overwhelmingly popular measures, initiatives. Raising the minimum wage garners consistently over 70% support in national polls, even for very ambitious targets like $15 an hour. And, you know, I think that rightly, advocates for raising the minimum wage and for establishing better economic security for families understand that, you know, a good way to win is taking the vote directly to the people where they have a chance to weigh in themselves. And, you know, currently polling in all of these states, in all four states, shows very strong support for these minimum wage increases, you know, kind of in keeping with what we've seen in previous elections, too. In 2014, the minimum wage increases were on the ballot in four states also, but they were also all four conservative states, and they all passed overwhelmingly with very broad support.
So do we expect that we're actually going to see voters vote yes in all of these states?
Yes, we currently do. I mean, certainly anything can happen. Certainly the opposition has been very vocal in a lot of these places, in particular in Colorado. They've been on the air with ads encouraging people to vote no, saying that the minimum wage increase is going to significantly crimp job growth. It's worth mentioning, of course, that, you know, many times this has been studied over and over again. There's just really no evidence to show that that's actually the case. However, it's not really stopping them from trying. Still, we do expect at the end of the day that these measures will pass with a pretty substantial margin.
Now, there's one state, South Dakota, that has a kind of an interesting ballot measure that's coming up, and that's one that would actually include a reduction in the minimum wage. What's going on in South Dakota?
Yes, it's for workers under 18. I think it's I don't actually know too much about the background on this particularly. I think, you know, certainly as advocates, we'd probably be a little bit more concerned about what was going on with it if they were trying to, you know, get a more ambitious proposal to decrease the minimum wage, you know, for all workers or, you know, for a wider variety of workers. I can't really speak to it too much other than to say that I would be surprised if it passes. I mean, if it does, probably just because it's narrowly tailored. But again, South Dakota is one of those states that in 2014 approved a minimum wage increase and it passed with broad support, even though South Dakota has the reputation of being a very conservative state. So clearly the minimum wage and a robust minimum wage enjoys support there as well.
And certainly a precedent that would be sort of drawing from the tipped minimum wage and also the sub-minimum wage that exists for people with disabilities in a way that feels like it could be a slippery slope to potentially bad other policies.
Certainly, yes. And actually, I mean, in the federal minimum wage now, it does have a teen minimum wage that is lower than the actual $7.25 also. But it is, it's very rarely used, seldom used, just because, frequently they, like the businesses that use it don't see enough benefit in doing that. And this is similar to that, but it's also, I think a policy that advocates have long warned against, tried to repeal in a couple of different iterations of legislation on the minimum wage at the federal level, but then also sort of warned against, including in other, whether they're state ballot measures or other federal bills, just because, it would give a lot of employers incentives to kind of cheat the system a little bit. And obviously that's something we don't want to see. Increasingly, even people under 18 are, they're relying on minimum wage incomes to make ends meet for their families. So it's, giving people under 18 a lower minimum wage is definitely going to hurt their economic security.
Well, and maybe just a slight variation on Newt Gingrich's famous proposal to make sure that kids in schools who get free and reduced price lunch have to work for those meals that they're getting. But I joke, but there's not a terribly big gap between where we could see this heading in terms of the incentives it would give employers and that kind of a ridiculous policy.
Absolutely. Newt Gingrich's big heart. Yes, he's found. Yes, he has a number of allies in people who are driving a lot of the policy on the other side for people who are trying to oppose minimum wage increases. And it's true, absolutely. I think you would definitely see a lot more employers, sort of use that as a way of getting out of helping their workers make ends meet.
So another policy that we're seeing on some ballots this fall is paid leave. What's going on there?
Yes, so very exciting, actually. In Arizona, in Washington, as part of the same ballot question as raising the minimum wage, there are also plans to enact a requirement for employers to offer employees paid sick leave, which is, incredibly important. Increasingly, we see that, particularly in minimum wage jobs or low wage jobs, they're most often the jobs that are likely to lack paid leave provisions. Often people in those jobs just don't really have a choice. They have to forego income whenever they're sick or one of their kids are sick or, someone in their family, potentially even put their own jobs at risk because they can't show up to work. These ballot questions in Arizona, in Washington, would effectively require employers to provide a little bit of sick leave for all of their employees. And that's, tremendously important. About 40% or 39%, I think, of people nationally lack paid sick leave. That rate goes up a lot higher for workers with lower incomes. This is something that we expect to actually really help a lot of workers continue to support their families and juggle the demands of work and home.
And do we see similar popularity among voters for paid family leave and paid sick leave policies?
We absolutely do. They tend to test off the charts, actually. Certainly on paid family leave, which is not on the ballot anywhere this year, the United States is one of the only countries in the world, and certainly the only developed country that doesn't have some sort of national paid leave policy, extended paid family leave policy. I think for reasons that are probably pretty intuitive to most people, it just makes sense. You should be able to say when you have a new child, you should be able to take some time away from work and help be there for your kid in the first 6, 12, 16, possibly longer than that. Some countries actually have much more generous leave policies. I think that's intuitive to people. People get that absolutely. So it's very, very popular. Paid sick leave is similarly popular. Nobody wants to get sick, and nobody can predict when they do get sick. So you need to be able to take the time off from work when you do. It's also, there are numerous studies that have showed paid sick paid sick leave is actually very important for the economy, and it has a very defined economic benefit. I mean, people, it generally makes workers happier and healthier in their jobs, and it's also a public health concern too. I mean, they're much less likely to spread whatever they've got. So it's just a no-brainer, really, and I think people get that, so the polling is consistently very high.
Yeah, particularly when you think about the share of workers in the restaurant industry who don't have paid sick days at all and are preparing our food. Mm-hmm. In the last minute I have with you, Ryan Erickson, so I guess I'm just curious, thinking about the role of not just turnout, but also completion of full ballots. What do we know about the share of voters who not just go to the polls, but mm-hmm. who actually fill out their ballots all the way, so that they're not just voting for president and maybe for, you know, whatever's going on, Senate races, House races? How many voters really get to the ballot measures?
Right. It is so important, really. But it is true. I mean, it's often very difficult. Some of these ballots, they get very long. Yeah, in particular, in California this year, I know that it's quite a lengthy ballot. But I mean, voters really, they really just do have to go down. They have to go through the entire ballot. I mean, there's some very important stuff, you know, all the way down. And these questions, too, in a number of states. I mean, some states tend to rely on ballot questions more than others. But they are, you know, some of these are incredibly important measures that are going to make a huge difference in the lives of millions of workers. So it's important to get all the way to the end. It's always important to do that. But you know, particularly these four ballot initiatives, Yes, I mean, we're you know, like, just encouraging or hoping everybody will get all the way through.
Ryan Erickson is the director of many state-related things in CAP's War Room. What is your actual title, Ryan?
Associate Director of Economic Campaigns.
Well, there we have it. And I've learned something today, too. But he's also going to be our correspondent on the state of the states, and he can state those state things for us, I hope, sometime soon. Thanks for joining Talk Poverty Radio, Ryan.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford because my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working, trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And then with these...